episode of season 4 of the Inbalance podcast. My name is Jim Simon, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kelsey Solberg. Inbalance animates Gonzaga's CREATE model for sustainability and the Laudato Si action platform goals. Through interviews and conversations with students, staff, faculty, and community members practicing sustainability on campus and in our region. Today, we're joined by Tristy Osman, the waste reduction educator at Gonzaga University serving through AmeriCorps.
Hello.
Hi. I loved this conversation. Something that stuck out for me was when we were talking about the different impacts of climate change. Tristy was talking about, for us as maybe Western folks in our Western countries, it's if and when versus other impacted nations and people. It's like here and now.
Yeah.
And that really stuck out to me, and I think made me think about how does this office, how does our university, how does our community posture ourselves around if and when versus here and now.
That's powerful. And recognizing too the privilege of the if and when. If and when, kind of what the privilege that comes with.
Yes.
Of being able to sort of look at it down the line into
right.
the future. Yeah.
That there's a runway to consider. Mm-hmm. Like, we could do this later. We have some time.
Yeah.
But others, it's not the case.
Yeah. And so much with, like, Worlds Collide is in that setting specifically, and she'll talk more about her experience at COP, but being there, I mean, and that's just all of that coming together, right? That's people who are in the here and now
yeah.
with people who have much longer runways, and yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a band who has, I think, lyrics, "What better place than here? What better time than now?" It's this Rage Against the Machine band
yeah.
from back in the day. I think of that often. What are we waiting for to take that action? What else stood out for you?
I think I really enjoyed hearing from her, and she talked about reflection, and that kind of came through in a couple different moments, even just the way that she was talking about kind of her own journey and there's been, like, for her, these moments where her path kind of has shifted, right? So she talked about that and deciding to go into environmental studies and then deciding to, you know, go down this waste reduction pathway too. Like, that, not things that she was maybe necessarily had her eye on, but she was willing to sort of, like, listen. And
yeah.
I don't think we're very good at that often. So, and she talked about that in coming back from her time at COP too, of having hope and, like, reflecting on that experience and being able to come away with it, away from it with that, with hope and solidarity. And, so I just thought it was a kind of a nice thread throughout her journey up to this point, you know,
yeah.
at 22 for her. I mean, there's still
yeah.
so much too that's ahead. So yeah.
As Taylor Swift was saying, something about, doesn't she have a song about 22?
I think she's feeling 22.
She's feeling 22.
I won't sing it.
No, good. I guess.
It is.
Yeah, I really enjoyed kind of you two talking about reflection and experience, because I felt compromised because I kind of put those words out there and animated them with my own meaning and for, like, almost 9 years. And the way that you two talked about them was almost so different than how I set it up. And so it was neat to see that kind of take shape based on your own experiences.
Mm.
So, like, experience and through my lens
yeah.
was, let's create opportunities for people to get involved. And I think that experience was also, like, not everyone has the same experience, that kind of view of experience, which is also very, very true and kind of bleeds into action and justice and how there's differential experiences around sustainability. So that was really neat for me to kind of keep quiet for a second and kind of listen and reflect. I wanted to, like, say, well, this is how I think. but I didn't think that was the right time or place.
That was very, very perceptive, I think. Yes. Well, and even from her perspective of saying, like, she was almost viewing it as a barrier, like, yeah. experience as a barrier to entry into yes. some of these, like, conversations, and that is true, and also probably not necessarily how it was meant, so I thought that yeah. was really
No, it's very
interesting.
True. Yeah. I feel like there are definitely spoken and unspoken credentials, mm-hmm. if you will. Those were air quotes for listeners. that sometimes exist in this sustainability world. You have to do this, this, or this. And have to is not, in my view, maybe yours too, required.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, she'll tell everyone so much more.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm excited for everyone to hear this one.
Mm-hmm. Enjoy.
Great. I was recording before, but you didn't know it.
But we didn't know.
Hi, Tristine.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Not bad. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, of course. I'm excited.
It was fun to earlier downstairs talk about hockey and the shared interest in watching hockey.
I think it's only fair that, like, the Canadian side of my family, it's representation.
Do you have
Canadian? Yeah, my grandpa's from Canada.
Okay.
So, nice. Lots of family over there.
Okay.
Yeah.
What part of Canada?
He was originally from, like, Hamilton area. Like, I don't know if you're aware.
I am very aware of Hamilton.
Yeah, but he was adopted and moved to BC and then was in, like, Revelstoke for... And so, like, that's where our, like, family, but it's, like, his adopted family.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
Hamilton is very close to Buffalo.
Yeah.
And so...
Most people don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, pass through Hamilton to go to Toronto. Mm-hmm. But I hear good things are happening in Hamilton, restaurants and such.
Yeah.
Do you know Matty Matheson? Do you know him?
No.
He's on, like, Vice. He has, like, some cooking shows.
Oh, no.
He's kind of has heavily tattooed personality. I think he is from the Hamilton area and has opened some restaurants there.
Sweet.
No, that's really cool, actually.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself. I know a little bit about you because obviously we work together. If I didn't know a lot about you or enough about you, that'd be weird.
Yeah. cause for concern.
But I know you're from Oregon.
Yeah.
And I also know that you grew up working on cars.
I did. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, I did.
Tell us more about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I guess contextually, I grew up in a small town in central Oregon. And I guess, like, as a little kid, I was forced to be outside a lot, and I hated it at the time. I was, like, not another weekend going camping or, like, being forced to work in the yard. and I think it's just, like, the thing you want to do the opposite of what you're told as a kid. But, like, once I was older, I realized that I really love the outdoors. And so I, like, started to explore a lot in, like, a lot of the cool spaces around Oregon. And then instead of taking... To get out of, like, AP Bio, I took AP Environmental Science.
Oh, that's a good move.
Yeah. Which was a good move. Hindsight. I didn't know what I was doing at the moment, though. And I think in that class, though, is when I first realized and, like, heard about, you know, kind of, like, climate change and everything. And realize that I've had this, like, deep instilled, like, care for the environment that I didn't realize just from being, like, outside a lot growing up. And so it was last minute change, like, my senior year of high school, where I was like, everything that I thought I was going to do, I'm absolutely not going to do. And now I want to study environmental science. And I'd already done, like, all the college applications, like, whatever it may be. So it still led me to go to Whitworth up the road. And that's kind of how I ended up in Spokane and studying environmental science. But I was met by a couple professors when I first got there, which I think is really interesting. And they listened to a lot of just, like, my frustrations and things about the environment. And they quickly convinced me to be an environmental science and theology major, which is a very mm-hmm. interesting combo that most people look at me and they're like, why would you ever do that? Like, what are you going to do with that? And I think studying that for 4 years, though, was very integral into just, like, who I am now, but also just, like, learning to engage with people and with, like, radically different ideologies than myself and be able to, like, be like, I see this. Maybe we can engage with this. Let's have a conversation. And also just, like, learning to communicate and write in different ways that I wouldn't have gotten from just, like, the STEM fields. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of just like took me down this crazy journey of jumping headfirst into everything with like research and going crazy places to do that, getting involved with a lot of like local agencies in Spokane. Yeah. And then, I mean, I was always aware of like GU, I think. It was kind of one of those places where it's like, I see it down the road. I don't know what's happening there. Yeah. So it was like always on my radar. And I think that kind of intersects like with 2020 and COVID. Obviously, we were in shutdown, and a lot of like the cracks in society's foundation, at least in my eyes, were undeniably like in the spotlight, and I couldn't like not engage with them, because you don't have like everyday life to kind of distract yourself. Yeah. And so that's where like a lot of I got engaged with a lot of like social justice, environmental justice stuff, and then I think like Gonzaga students were also involved with that, like once we kind of came back to Spokane doing like marches and rallies, and so there was like engagement and different things happening and like things that I was getting involved with, and just like it all kind of came together, and led me to be here. But yeah, a little bit about myself.
Glad you're here.
Yeah.
I think you said you went to some crazy places.
Yeah. Some crazy places. I mean, like, combination of theology and environmental science, I got to go to Greece and study, like, how the Orthodox Church there put the environment at, like, the head of their agenda and, like, what they're doing, and live there for a month. And I got to live in Costa Rica for a month doing water quality research and how, like, anthropogenic land use is affecting it, which is, like, on the like more exotic side, I feel like. But then also like here, I got to intern with the Spokane Conservation District, and I got to meet like a lot of local landowners around the Spokane area and engage with them and what they're doing. So different contexts, I guess, like both local and abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that an existing like dual major, or was it just sort of like major in both of these things and then kind of see how they?
Yeah, so I was just like double majoring in both simultaneously, and there was a little overlap because the environmental science major or the theology major has an environmental studies emphasis track that you can like kind of go down, which is also really unique, and so yeah, I don't think many people really do that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think with like. So actually the Office of Sustainability put this on this was a couple of years ago, the Employee Sustainability Ambassador Program on campus. And I was part of the pilot cohort. And I remember that was the first time I'd read the Dow Cho Si. And I was like, oh, this is, because I grew up Catholic and I have, you know, like my own kind of experience with that and just kind of like Christianity in general. And did not see a lot of like natural overlaps between that and, you know, and the environment or climate justice in general. And I think that was really eye-opening for me. And then just like hearing other intersections, it feels like kind of counterintuitive counterintuitive. But it's neat to hear that was kind of that was posed to you and that your experience of it was really, really rich too.
Yeah, like. Definitely.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I feel like you live in a lot of like silos almost unintentionally of like these things are inherently in conflict, but I think it intersects with everything, so that's cool.
That's awesome.
What's your favorite spot in Oregon, outdoor spot?
That's a hard question. I think, okay, so you know how we do all the photos downstairs of like, what's your favorite outdoor space? I think I sat there for like 3 hours being like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what to send you.
What is this guy asking?
I was like, oh, I don't know. What,
you're like, what time of year? It depends.
Exactly.
How do I feel?
I feel like when I think of Oregon, though, I always think of like the Cascade Mountain Range and like being, I think the photo downstairs is Sparks Lake, and like being somewhere in that area is always, it's really nice.
Oh, I have a funny story about that photo. So Tristy sent it to me and I was like, this is very familiar.
Really?
So then I like went back in time and I was like, found a photo of me, I think in that almost exact spot.
Whoa.
At the same lake.
Yeah.
I was like, is this the same spot? And I sent Tristy the picture.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
When I got that text, I was so confused because you were like, is that Sparks Lake? And I was like, yes. Like, why am I feel concerned about this?
How do you know?
Yeah, exactly.
How long ago were you there?
What's that?
How long ago had you been there?
It's like 2018 or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. It was like a trip to Bend and then went down there and like very popular kind of little, I felt like a peninsula where you park or try to park and then
it's one of the most most like popular lakes on the Cascade Lakes Road, and so it's like everyone is for aggressive to get there.
Is it Sparse or Sparks?
Sparks.
Sparks Lake. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Maybe like 45 minutes from Bend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That. Okay. It's really close.
Oh, sweet.
So.
Okay.
To check that one out.
Yeah.
And you like along that road, definitely do it.
I've done it's called the Cascade Lakes Relay. It's like a...
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I've done that a couple times, but I feel like we only ever are near, like we're only actually near like one or two.
Yeah.
There should be names.
There's a lot.
we're near them, but we're not like running around them as much, but yeah. So what do you do here? What is your work at Gonzaga now?
Yeah, I guess my technical long title is the Higher Education Waste Reduction Educator, which is just too much of a mouthful. So I just say
two educators.
Yes.
Two educators.
So I do waste education on campus is what I say. Okay. And I feel like I have lots of arms in different areas, whether that's like data stuff or like educating students and staff and like doing cool new projects, whatever it may be.
What type of projects are you working on here?
It's a good question. I feel like, honestly, a lot of my work this year has been trying to kind of, like, consolidate a lot of things and make it, like, what is already existing better and elevate it more rather than, like, let's add more, like, confusing projects to the mix before everything is, like, a baseline.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know if that makes sense, but...
No, it does. I mean, that's helpful. I'm sure there's a lot of different... Because everyone kind of has, like, ideas in many different places.
Yes, definitely.
Kind of trying to orchestrate all of that.
Yeah. Everyone has their own, like, definition of sustainability.
I think waste ends up being, like, the perfect storm of higher education because you have the conveyor belt of students who are kind of moving through over 4 to 5 years. So you're constantly having to reshare things. At the same time, you know, you have outside forces changing. So like in the last 5-6 years, the waste kind of industry has drastically changed. And so responding to that and then responding to people coming from different places with their own practices. Yeah. Like if you came from Seattle or San Francisco, you're very likely to wish cycle or wish compost things that you were able to do that back home, but we don't do it here. So it's all these like exceptions to rules that makes it hard to kind of coalesce. But that's why Tristy's position exists.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I've never heard wish cycling. When you said I'm like, I know what that means, but I've never had a name for it.
Because I think it's like, I think a lot of people probably do it, but I think people who, it's like at the edge of laziness and hopefulness, we're like, well, it's partially someone else will figure this out, or it should be recycled.
Like it's plastic, it makes sense.
It makes sense that it should go here, so I'm going to make it so.
Yeah.
But I think we've learned over the last few years that that is actually less helpful because the things that should be recycled, there's a good reason why, because they'll gum up really complicated machines.
I know, I always say that I used to do that a lot, like before I was like a lot more aware of things, and I would always be like, it's cardboard, it can be recycled, and it absolutely couldn't. So everyone's at fault, unfortunately.
So with the waste reduction, was that something that you were already, like, were you sort of looking or interested in this?
No, absolutely not. I feel like that's one of the morals of, like, my personal life is, like, everything I thought I would be doing is absolutely not what I actually am doing.
That continues to be true in my experience.
Yeah. Because, so, like, also contextually, like, at Whitworth, there was multiple-year conversation around, like, bringing the 3-bin waste stream to campus.
Okay.
And just based off of, like, the narrative and inaction happening and lots of other things, it would get brought up and I'd just get really frustrated. And I was like, I'd roll my eyes at you and she'd be like, this isn't even worth our time. Like, this is irrelevant to everything. And so, like, waste was at, like, the lowest priority of my list.
Okay.
And that's not to say, like, I thought it was irrelevant because I grew up, like, learning to recycle, like, what I could and, like, composting at home and doing those types of things. But I don't think I ever made the connection of, like, this is super important for, like, this reason. I just knew it was, like, the right thing to be doing.
Yeah.
And so kind of how I got here, I guess, is my personal life took, like, a huge pause in the spring of my senior year. I, like, ended up being in the hospital for a long time and getting, like, crazy random surgery for like cardiovascular stuff. And so I found myself just being like super reliant on everyone around me and not being able to like do anything independently. And so I was like, well, my life is not going to be backpacking for 4 days out of the week in the Idaho Selkirks, and it's not going to be moving to Florida like I thought. And so I was kind of like, what can I like realistically actually physically do? And so I was surfing LinkedIn a lot, and I found this job, and I was like, well, not my favorite thing, but I could do it. And like, I'm passionate about things that like lie in this realm. So like, what's the worst thing about putting an application in?
Yeah.
And then fast forward, and I got the job, and I was really excited about it, which was also like something I didn't expect. But I was like, it felt like one of those things where like my senior year of high school, where I was like, actually environmental science is something I'm like really passionate about, this is cool. And then I like got the job, and I was like, actually this is something that I think is really cool. And so it's connections, I guess. But
it's awesome.
Yeah, so not something that's always like been on my mind.
Yeah, wasn't planned for.
No, definitely not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you know who else was in a hospital bed and had a massive personal transformation?
Who?
Saint Ignatius.
Oh yeah. Let's bring it back around. Hey-o. Like,
I think he had a different access to medical care.
Yeah, probably.
May have led to him having hallucinations and visions of, I don't know.
Of things.
Of things.
Yeah.
But he made it so we're all here today, in a way.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, beautiful.
What made you choose National Service through AmeriCorps? I think this, you presented this as a job. I think we know
it's
service, as I'm asked to say by AmeriCorps. The powers that be. Mm-hmm. But like, what, obviously, you could be tempted to say that you gave up some things to do AmeriCorps, but like, what maybe, so others might know, what did you give up and what are you gaining?
I mean, honestly, I don't feel like I actually gave up any, like, I had to give up my original plan, but that wasn't really, like, on the table for me not to do. Like, I had to be here for another year, which makes it sound like I don't want to be here. I promise I do. But, I mean, I feel like I had been exposed to a lot of people doing different things post-graduation through, like, senior seminar stuff in college. And I had heard a lot about, like, AmeriCorps, and my professor was like, you should look at AmeriCorps. You should look at AmeriCorps. And I was like, okay, what is this? And it was just kind of one of those, I think, perfect storm examples of, like, I can stay here where I'm, like, not ready to leave, and I get really great, like, benefits, and I get to do something, like, professional development-wise, like, in something that I'm passionate about, which I didn't realize, like, AmeriCorps necessarily offered. And so it doesn't feel like, I don't know if I should say that, but it doesn't feel like national service almost. Like, I'm giving up something to be, like, serving here. It's like, I'm actually, like, giving something, and I feel like I'm gaining a lot and, like, growing a lot as a person.
I think I messed that up, because I think I entered that question with the presumption that to do service, you have to give up something.
Yeah.
Or do less, or do to, like, leave something behind, but you perfectly debunk that.
Of course. Well, because, I mean, I guess maybe it'd be different if you're, like, moving across the country or something, and you're, like, leaving behind whatever, like, ties you may have, but, I mean, they made it very accessible, at least in this position. It feels like a really great transition, not, like, giving up everything.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
But I think you brought up, I mean, there have been members who have served in the office who have come from really far away, and I think you're right, it's a different transition. Coming from somewhere else and being kind of landed here without community, but
definitely that'd be hard.
So you probably remember from like orientation and just me mentioning the CREATE model, the care for creation, reflection, experience, action, teaching, engagement, and I think as we look at that, we also, there's a lot of alignment with the Laudato Si action platform goals, almost the same. And as you graduated from Whitworth and serving here now, how do you connect with maybe the action platform goals or the CREATE model? What pieces of that, since we know that waste is something you're leaning into, like what pieces of sustainability in the model resonate with you the most?
Yeah, I feel like when I saw the Create model, it was one of those things where I was like, that makes sense. I relate to like almost everything that's a part of it before I even knew that it existed. Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, right off the bat, like Care for Creation, at least thinking in like Laudato Si terms or like kind of like a theological mindset, like it is kind of an inherently like theological saying. And so relating that to, I mean, work and also like context that we're in, there's like a clear call to care for the creation that's around us, which is really cool that that's like even a part of it. But also like even outside of like that context too, it's just like care for the things that are around you. Like we each individually like have our own responsibility of things to be doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's cool to see it in the model, I guess. And I think also like, like reflection is also, I think, one of the big ones for me as well, that I connect with or at least like resonate with. Because I think from reflection, if you don't reflect on things, like you're not going to make it personable or you're not going to like connect with it on the same level of like you could live in ignorant bliss for the rest of your life if you don't like reflect on things that are happening, or like you don't reflect on waste in my case. But like through reflection, you kind of gain, I think, ways to like understand it deeper and have it like bubble up with emotions, but like understand that and maybe like lead into action, which is like the next part of it. And also like gain maybe like sympathy or empathy towards other things that you wouldn't. And I mean, I could dissect, I think, every single part of the Create model if you really wanted to, but I think all of it's pretty relatable. I think the only thing I might have a little bit hesitancy towards is the experience. And I think that's probably just personal, where like I've seen it used in a negative way towards like women and children or like minority groups or other like groups in general of like, we're not inviting you to the table or to the conversation because you don't have like quote unquote experience. Yeah. And it's like, that's really frustrating. And also like, how dare you say that to someone who like has lived experience in something that you may not know, and you're leaving out like half of society and their lived experiences in different things. But that's also a rabbit hole that we could go down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's, it's interesting. I think I've thought about experience as more like the latter half of what you mentioned, of like the lived experience component of it. So like what's already sort of like what the experiences that folks bring, rather than like bringing experience to them, if that makes sense, or like requiring experience or something.
Yeah.
But I, so it's really interesting kind of hearing that in a different way.
Yeah. It could just be my view on it, but it definitely, maybe in my personal experiences with it too, where it's like you're kind of barred from these conversations because XYZ experience, whatever it may be.
I think that, I mean, that's like apparent and or present in higher ed for sure. I think we feel that. I feel that a lot.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of the dynamics we have here.
Yeah, and it's frustrating.
Yeah, I think it's good to be a little bit critical of that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely has its place though too. Like without experience, you can't do a lot of things. So double-edged sword, too many things.
Yeah. Yeah. The piece on reflection I think is good too, because that's like, that's how we know that we're moving forward, if we can like look back and see, you know, like that's the only way that we're going to be able to make any type of progression.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And I think all parts of it too kind of flow into the next.
Mm-hmm.
Like reflection flows into experience, flows into action, so on and so on.
I wish I could say that Pope Francis consulted us with the 7 goals, but he did not.
Dang it.
Wait, are we missing one then? There's only 6 letters there.
Oh, I don't know.
Maybe that's why I didn't stop.
Wait,
by.
Did I
oh, that's Create. So there's 7 in Laudato Si.
Okay. Are those all pieces of it?
Almost.
Okay. Yeah.
There's
yeah.
like listening to the cry of the earth, the cry of the poor, ecological, economics, education, kind of like action, and then there's 2 more. I'm still committing them to memory. But like they're very similar. So I think depending on who you're talking to or with, one could say that we've been doing the Laudato Si action platform stuff for the last, you know, 8 years. But
just
or it's just a frame.
Yeah.
Different labels, yeah.
No, it's cool hearing you talk about it from like being a recent
student, like mm-hmm. being a student recently in Spokane at an institution that does feel like kind of like a sister sort of in Spokane, and having that experience, and then now your connection to Gonzaga. It's just cool to kind of hear how you connect to that. You just got back from Egypt, right?
Well, recently.
We want to hear about that. What were you doing there?
I had the opportunity to go to the United Nations Climate Change Conference, which was crazy.
So cool.
Yeah, and chaotic, but so cool.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing there.
What was it like? Like, what stood out to you?
The whole experience was just kind of crazy. I feel like, I've never even been to that part of the world before, and it was very, like, nerve-wracking. I think, obviously, we hold a lot of stereotypes mm-hmm. of what that area is like, whatever it may be, but, I think, like, that side of it was great, because it broke down a lot of stereotypes and whatever, but, just being, like, at COP itself, though, and being, like, a participant of it, and, like, having access and being an observer, felt like a lot of imposter syndrome, because mm-hmm. it was, like, I'm a 22-year-old woman that lives in Spokane, and not at the forefront of the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. Like, what am I doing here? Like, I'm an AmeriCorps member and I work in waste. Like, what the heck? Mm-hmm. But also just, like, being able to lean into that and, like, learn from everyone around me and seeing how many crazy, like, people it draws from around the world, and kind of encouraging, like, there was over 30,000 people there.
Wow.
And that, minus the 600 oil executives, like, we're all there because they care about trying to, like, mitigate and adapt to what's mm-hmm. happening in our world. And that was just, yeah, that was really encouraging, I think, but yeah.
What, organization did you go there with? I know you went there with a mm-hmm. group that was yeah. kind of people from across the world came mm-hmm. together.
Yeah. I went, it's called CCOP, so it's like COP, but not CCOP. but it's called the Christian Climate Observers Program. So again, like, inherently Christian group, but it's an international kind of organization, I guess you could say. And so anyone from around the world could apply. And so this year there was 9 countries represented, from Australia to the Philippines to, like, the UK to Canada and the US. So, like, very wide range of people. But the institution itself that I went with wasn't, like, an accredited member of the UNFCCC, which is, I think, something I mentioned because it's really unique. They partner with a bunch of other organizations, and those organizations that are accredited give them their badges, because badges are, like, the most limiting thing to being able to get into COP grounds. Mm-hmm. And so member organizations, essentially, that have never met these 30-some individuals give them their badges so that they can go and, like, be at a conference that they otherwise wouldn't be able to be at, and then go back and, like, share with their communities mm-hmm. and be, like, representatives of those communities that otherwise wouldn't be represented. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's very unique.
That is. Mm-hmm. What were some of the, I think, you know, as I go back and look at, like, COP highlights, basically, yeah. like, watching some of the really powerful, you know, speeches or, you know, like, activism that's happening there, what stood out to you with that? I mean, was there yeah. anything that, like, really
definitely changed out? I think it depends on, like, what area of the conference you're in, because there's, like, the standard, like, blue zone where, like, civil society kind of, like, hangs out, and that's where, like, stunts happen, which are basically, like, protests, and you okay. can, like, talk with people from all the countries that have their little pavilions and organizations. And so there's stuff that happens in that side that's different than, like, the red zone, which is where, like, all the official negotiations happen mm. and where you can, like, go and sit as an observer in the very back and have to just be, like, completely silent, but yeah. you can, like, listen to everything that they're saying. And so, like, in terms of red zone and negotiations, loss and damage was at the prominent, like, forefront of this COP. And listening to just, like, different outcries, I guess, from, like, less developed countries and, like, island nations that are really, really tiny was really powerful. I think I always wrap back around to this, but there was really early on in the week, they were kind of not negotiating yet, but kind of responding to, like, a document that they had received about, like, kind of what they were going to be negotiating, I guess. And Fiji got up on the podium, and also that was the other thing, too, with, like, negotiations. I would assume it's, like, kind of a round table like this and people getting angry. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, American politics definitely, like, playing into that. Mm-hmm. But it was very, like, calm. It was, like, the calmest area on the conference. Mm-hmm. And it was very, like, orderly, which I was just very shocked to see. But yeah. Fiji got up on the podium and was, again, like, very small island nation. And they were just, like, listen, we're all hostages in this car driving on the highway to hell, like, and all we've asked for is a seatbelt and to slow down, and, like, you can't even do that. Mm-hmm. And it was just this really powerful moment, I think, of, like, they're bold enough to, like, stand up in front of all of these world leaders and representatives of countries and be like, you're causing this, and all we've literally asked for is, like, precautionary acts, and, like, no one is even willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And now we're, like, basically doomed. And so that really sticks with me, and I've carried that, I think, since the COP conference in terms of negotiations. Yeah,
that's a really powerful metaphor. Mm-hmm. Too.
That is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Sitting there, I was like, oh, we are going there. But yeah, it was, yeah, really cool. But then, like, I guess in, like, Blue Zone stuff, I think just interacting with people from so many different countries and people that were in our group as well that come from so many different contexts is something that sticks with me. Mm-hmm. Again, like, loss and damage was the most prominent thing that was being discussed, and I got to sit down with people from Ukraine one afternoon, and, like, it was like, you have the biggest reason not to be here, yet you're, yeah, one of the most engaged people. Mm-hmm. And that's already something that, like, is admirable. But being able to just kind of, like, understand, like, the destruction that's happening, but then being engaged in, like, climate activism and all of this stuff is just crazy. And hearing about really, like, tragic stories from other countries around Africa too is very impactful. Yeah.
Sorry, I have to cough. We're gonna forget this out. Excuse me.
Just writing down that time.
Whoops. Thank you. Jeez. Cough 30.
It's okay. It's a good pause.
Let's get it all out.
Pause. Everybody cough.
I know, I'm like, you're gonna hear me, like, dumping my water in the background.
Oh, quick intermission.
There we go.
Great.
What did you bring back from Egypt, and then what do you wish you left there?
That's a good question. I think after 2 months of reflection about, like, my experience in Egypt, I kind of boil it down to 4 main things that I brought back with me, which I've probably already kind of touched on. But one being that, like, loss and damage, like, the idea that higher emitting countries have the responsibility to, like, pay for and, like, repair the damage they've done to other countries, isn't something to be talked about in, like, a abstract way. And I think, at least in the West and here in, like, Spokane and Washington, we have a privilege of being like, if and when, like, climate migration happens, mm-hmm, or if and when, like, these things happen. But realizing that, like, other people around the world are experiencing that, like, here and now, and we have a responsibility to, like, act on that is a really big, big takeaway, and something that I've been, like, I think thinking about a lot and wrestling with, of, like, what does that actually tangibly look like in this context? And not kind of just, like, living ignorantly and being like, well, when climate migration affects our area. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing, I think. And another is understanding the frustration and, like, inherently slow process, because I think there's a lot of, like, rightfully so frustration in being like, this takes forever, like, why are you still, like, going to COP conferences? They don't do anything. Like, people are just arguing, like, governments have failed us. I think that's a common narrative. Mm-hmm. And I use this example too, but I went to a briefing with John Kerry one afternoon, and he was like, one moment, he was like, we have one of the biggest economies in the world, like, blah, 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 it's so great. And then, like, 5 seconds later, it was like, but we have no money for climate finance. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And it's like, how can you sit there and say, like, contradictory things, like, 5 seconds apart from each other? But being able to sit down with one of his, like, head cabinet members, like, later that afternoon and talk about, like, A, in U.S. context, they're given, like, a stagnant fund in their cabinet to, like, essentially, like, divvy out towards a bunch of different, like, programs and things. And so, like, they don't have the ability, and it's, like, well, if you want this to be financed, like, what do you want us to, like, cut and slash, like, all of these other important programs? And it's like, okay, that's perspective, I guess, that I needed. but also, I guess, in terms of, like, the UN and, like, COP conferences, at least 198 members are coming together, and they all have their own agendas and, like, things that they want to accomplish, so no one's gonna, like, agree on something unanimously the first time that it's brought to the table. So, like, the way that the system is built is trying to create a system of equality between, like, vastly different and different sized countries. And so, like, that is just going to be a slow process. And so, like, understanding that but not excusing, like, the inaction that has, like, happened and the action that still needs to take place, I think is a big thing that I've also been thinking about. And one of the last things that I brought home, I guess I said three slash four.
3.5.
Yeah, exactly. It's like solidarity and hope. And so, like, there was a big thing at the end of the week where it was like kind of all the people at the conference came together, and there wasn't any, like, official delegates or whatever it may be, like, party members, but it was all just, like, observers and people that were there. And essentially it was just like, there's so much power in solidarity with the people, and so much power in finding solidarity with, I mean, obviously, like, people that are so different than you. But solidarity is what, like, governments and corporations fear the most, because in solidarity, there's a ton of power with the people and, like, kind of a unified voice that comes together, and they can't ignore that. And so finding, like, solidarity, and solidarity doesn't mean, like, going to every COP conference, but it can be, like, finding solidarity with the people in, like, local communities and, like, what you're doing and engaging in. Which I think is a really cool perspective to have of, like, this is actually, like, making a difference, and we do have, like, a lot of power and say in what we're doing. And so, like, that's also, like, hand-in-hand with, like, having hope in something that you're doing. Because, like, without hope, obviously, this is a very depressing field to be in, and can be, like, very, I don't know. It's just easy to get down, I think, if you don't have hope in something. Mm-hmm. And so I guess those are, like, the four main things I brought home with me, which is a lot. I apologize. Rapid fire.
No, that's great. Yeah. I'm encouraged to hear you use the word hope. I actually was wondering, when you were talking about just your experience there, I wanted to ask, like, did you leave feeling hopeful, or was there sort of that kind of a little bit of doom? Which often it's both, right? Like, it's just,
And that was going to be my answer, honestly. Yeah. Like, yeah, there is hope, but also, like, obviously time is ticking, so it feels a bit doomsday-esque.
Yeah, yeah. Or more dire.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. But the other part of the question is, what did I wish I left there?
Yes, that's correct.
Good questions. I feel like, in terms of, like, what made me really, like, frustrated while I was there, that I wish I just didn't have to, like, or I wish it just wasn't a thing, is just, like, the blatant greenwashing that took place. And so there was a ton of things that probably happens at all COPs, but, like, I guess at this one, like, in the Egypt context, like, they were basically just, like, making themselves look so much, like, better and more green than, like, what they were. And there was, like, a sign at one of the main entrances that was like, go green, use natural gas, with, like, a picture of a car. And I was like, how are we at a climate change conference and this is what you're advertising? And, like, they also, I mean, like, they don't necessarily have, like, an adequate waste system, but I think with my perspective of working in waste, it was like, how are we at a climate change conference and, like, there's literally no, like, recycle or compost to be seen? Like, I don't know where to dispose of my stuff. And so, like, that aside also, like, there was, like, 600 oil executives that were there that were getting smaller countries to do, like, their dirty work in the negotiations. And so, like, why are we still allowing, like, oil executives who obviously don't necessarily have the same end goal as we do, and historically we can see that, like, why are we still allowing them into this conference and to, like, basically bribe other countries to do their dirty work? Like, that seems not cool, but okay. So, like, things like that are definitely things that I wish I just, like, didn't have to, like, I wish it just didn't happen, and I wish that, like, Coca-Cola, which is, like, one of the biggest fossil fuel investing companies, didn't sponsor the entire conference and have their name on every plaque, and were giving away, like, free Coke products the whole 2 weeks. Like, I don't know. There was just a lot of, like, frustrations, I guess, that would have been nice to, like, not happen and could just be left. Yeah.
But I think you noticing those and sharing them, I think, not that I follow every conference, but, like, I wouldn't have guessed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, me either.
And I wouldn't have known that there was that kind of greenwashing
yeah.
piece. So like you sharing it and bringing that back, even though you wanted to leave it there, mm-hmm. I think is important to know that it's not all that we think it is.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Which I think is fair as to why people are like, why do you still engage with these if like this is happening?
Yeah.
You know, there's like also that narrative out there, but without like going to COP conferences and engaging with it and having like 198 members come together, when would those conversations ever like realistically actually happen? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing on that too is like next year, because COP rotates regions of the world that it's in, like it's in Dubai, mm-hmm. so it's like in another really oil dependent yeah. rich
yeah.
country.
Yeah.
So like that's setting the scene also, mm-hmm. And being aware of that.
Yeah. So personal action or collective action or both? Let's talk about it.
My initial is both.
Both?
Yes. And explanation for both, I guess. I think with individual, like, both are necessary and needed in the world. And I think if you remove individual action and say, like, oh, it's only corporations, it's only, like, big companies, which, while yes, like, they're primary contributors and have a lot of responsibility in it, if, like, we're only pointing, the finger at them, we remove ourselves from the equation, and it just feels like we can disengage and, like, live our lives and be like, well, this doesn't really matter anyways, right. like, whatever. Mm-hmm. And again, in, like, I think a Western context and a country that inherently has done a lot of damage, like, we have ability to have, like, to do something about it and have a responsibility to, like, engage and be like, if I do this, like, it is actually helping in the long run. But then also, so that's why I guess there's that both piece to it.
Yeah. I imagine it's a pretty Western construct to think that you can separate community from
yeah.
being yourself.
Yeah.
yeah, there's, yeah. Yeah. I think it's both. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's both for sure. But people have varying opinions about it.
Yeah. I think, like you said, one of them does make it feel easier to kind of be more apathetic. It's easier mm-hmm. to just kind of check out if you feel like, well, there's nothing I can do anyway. You know, if I yeah. separate my mm-hmm. plastics out and figure out where everything needs to go, is that really going to make a difference? And yeah.
Yeah, I think it is too. And I also think, like, it's not necessarily even just, like, I'm doing the right thing by, like, separating my trash, but also, like, we live in an inherently, like, consumeristic society, so, like, individual action also can rely, or, like, boil down to, like, where you're using your dollar.
Yeah.
And, like, supporting those things is also, I think, a very good way to have action in that yeah. sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of our primary tools.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So most of the people who, all seven of our listeners,
seven.
Most of our seven listeners, I'm just kidding, I have no idea how many people are listening, but knowing, you know, that they're coming from kind of like our Gonzaga community and thinking about the work that you do in waste reduction, mm-hmm. is there anything, that you kind of want to like leave us with today in terms of like the work that you're doing on campus, like what feels like just a friendly reminder
or words of wisdom.
Do people who are engaged in Gonzaga community need to know about waste reduction, what's going on
yeah,
here, you know,
that's
I think
true.
Is, you know, myself being part of this community, like there's a lot that I know where our bins are in our mm-hmm. office and I use them to the best of my knowledge and I think I'm doing it right, but I don't know.
Yeah.
What do I need to know?
I feel like there's layers to that question. Like, I can answer it many ways or many, like, steps.
Yeah.
In terms of, I guess, I don't know, that's a big question. I feel like one thing, I guess if it's, like, Gonzaga-affiliated people that listen, one thing that we've been talking about a lot, at least in, like, the Spokane context of waste and waste reduction, is... A, like, yes, recycling is real. So many students are like, is recycling actually real? Yes, yes, it is. but also, like, not with cycling and making mm-hmm. sure that, like, everything that you are sorting, like, taking the extra minute to really do that does really, like, help a lot. One example I can use is we've been doing things at the basketball games, and I've been, like, weighing all the trash that comes out. And mm-hmm. it's, like, while there is, like, the 3-stream waste option... there's so much contamination that it's like it all will end up in the landfill if it's not done correctly, which is really like obviously contradictory to the point.
Yeah.
But also like simple things like, I mean, keeping plastic bags out of the recycling, I mean, it's so simple, but it's like that's something tangibly that you could do. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of different like waste reduction too. Like it's not like once you start doing waste reduction, I also feel like there's this weird stereotype where it's like, oh my gosh, you use something that's single use, like you're not actually, like you don't care, like how dare you. And it's like finding what works for you. It's like imperfectly perfect type of stuff. Mm-hmm. So like what works for me in my waste reduction, like in my personal life, may not work for you, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. Like finding what you're passionate about and works is all great strides towards the right thing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Do you have any more questions before we do our fun little rapid fire?
I don't think I do. I'm trying to think. Oh, tell us the car that you have and in Oregon.
Yeah, that's a good question. I own a 1963 Galaxy, which is a very old car, but I grew up in a car family, and so when we all turn 16, it's like a rite of passage that we all buy this like old car and restore it. And so yeah, so that's the car that I bought and have since restored with my family. Mostly a lot of my brothers and my dad's help.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Do you name the cars?
Yeah.
What's this one's name?
It's a very sad. My car's name is Walter, and I did that because it's always like, it acts just like an angry and like frustrated old man that like it just is, and I just feel like the name fits. Like, apologies to anyone that's named Walter, but but like all of our cars kind of have names. So yeah.
I love that.
That's a good segue.
Yeah. Perfect.
Great.
Yes. Okay, well these are just, yeah, this is our rapid fire. These can be fun answers. But so the first one is, they don't have to be fun though.
No, I know that Tristy has been dreading this part.
I really have been, and now it's like being worked up too, and so I'm like, what am I getting myself into?
No, that's good.
I'm not helping by laughing.
No, it's devious.
What is a book that you think everyone should read?
Ooh, that's a good question.
See, good question.
Yeah.
That's my favorite book, but just what do you think everyone should read?
Yeah, I think that's a great thing. Maybe kind of on the bandwagon, I feel like Braiding Sweetgrass is a really great book that is pretty popular, but it does like a really great job of connecting like stories and knowledge and wisdom that I don't think we normally would have in our context, and connecting it with STEM, which is really cool. But also another book I think is really great. Maybe I'll give you two for one. It's called Encounters with the Arc Druid. It's really good. It's by John McPhee, and it kind of follows this character that has a very like preservationist ideology around, and like all of the different characters that he like interacts with essentially that represent other like ideologies, like just extract all the resources, it doesn't matter, like conservation. But it's bound in this really great story that you don't necessarily like pick up right away. And so I think that's always a great read.
It's a novel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's just a singular. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's short. It's like 200 pages. Well, maybe that's not short to most people, but it doesn't seem like a thick book. Yeah.
It's not a doorstopper is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the last concert that you went to?
I went to Chelsea Cutler actually in the fall. I forgot that was the most recent concert.
Where was it at?
In Spokane.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay. It's like the best way I describe her music is like Sad Girl Hours music.
We all have this.
Yes, but it's great.
It's awesome. What's your favorite restaurant in Spokane?
Okay, this... I think it is embarrassing. Everything's embarrassing to me. But
Zips?
No. Okay.
What a great answer.
No. I've lived here for like 5 years, and I just don't frequently like eat out.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I don't know, like, what it... Like, whenever, like, my family comes into town, they're like, where should we go out to dinner? And I'm, like, stress. I'm like, I have no clue. Like, I don't know. And they're like, you live here. Don't you eat out? And I'm like, I don't know. But I guess breakfast is my favorite meal, and you cannot go wrong with, like, the Brunchonette, I feel like. That's great. Cool. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Brunchonette. What's your go-to up there?
They have a really good vegan dish. I don't remember what it's called. Okay, nice. But it's, like, one of the only ones on the menu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have chilaquiles. Do you have those?
It sounds familiar.
It's basically like, it's like breakfast nachos, I feel like.
Okay.
It's
really good. That sounds good.
It's not vegan, but.
That's it.
How did you get to work today?
I drove.
Me too.
So did I.
Okay, great.
Do you have one closet?
Yeah.
I live up north. That's my excuse. And it was cold and snowy.
Yeah, it is not. Yeah, it is February after
yeah.
all. Okay, the final one. So finish this sentence. In 2030, Spokane will
be better, hopefully.
That's perfect.
I'm so sorry.
That was great. I think everyone else like pauses. Like if I were to look at the like
yeah.
screen, they're like, it's like just nothing.
Yeah.
Be better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that can mean a lot of things,
it
which I hope
mm-hmm.
it's all of them. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So good.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah,
yeah, of course.
It's
I appreciate it.
Nice to talk
it.
To you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
I do talk to you most days.
I hope so. Yes, thank you guys. I
yeah.
appreciate it. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, it was good to meet you too. This was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.